Okay. All right.
87 degrees.
Oh, yes. It's going to be beautiful. All right. Proverbs 22:13. This is the one I want. 22:13. Proverbs. Dude, you were on it. That was impressive. I was waiting to say it 16 more times before people went, what book are we in? Which? Psalms? Psalms? I don't have Psalms. No, Proverbs. Is that in the Old Testament? Good job, Evan. Yeah, turn it to the middle. The sluggard says, there's a lion outside. I will be killed in the streets. Okay, what is a sluggard? A lazy person, okay? And what is this sluggard saying?
There's a lion.
There's a lion, right? I can't, you know, there's a lion outside, right? Turn to 26:13, same proverb. With more to follow, the sluggard says in verse 13, there's a lion in the open road, a lion in the open square. Why is he saying this? Why is the proverb, or why is the sluggard making this statement? See also verse 14. Keep reading, Evan. I knew I'd stump you. 26:14. Or somebody else. Why is the sluggard... Yeah, that sounds like a guy saying this from his bed. As the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard on his bed. Why is the sluggard making the statement? Oh, there's a lion in the street. There's a lion in the open square. Right. I don't want to get up. I don't want to get out of bed. As the door turns on its hinges, right? 15, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish, is wearing it to bringing his mouth again. So, I mean, that's pretty bad when you can get your fork in the dish, but you can't bring it to your face, right? Because you're, I quit. That's a lot of work. Can someone just bring the food to my mouth for me, right? What do we call this? What is he doing? What is he making? Excuses, right? These are excuses because he doesn't want to do the necessary work, right? I always think of the old awful saying that excuses are like armpits. Everyone has one and they all stink, right? That's the reality of this guy, okay? I like armpits. Anyway, feet, I don't know. Whatever stinks on your body, that's the excuse, right? Yeah, the idea is everyone's got a terrible excuse. Everyone sees through it and says, that guy's an idiot. You're lazy. You just don't want to get out of bed. You don't want to do the hard work, right? It's a pretty easy to interpret, pretty easy to apply proverb. Okay, the idea is that that is a characteristic of those that do not want to put in the difficult, necessary work to get whatever job done needs to get done. Okay, so as a reminder to all of us, let this quality not mark us, that we are men and women that have wonderful, creative excuses for why we can't get the job done, why we can't perform, why we can't get out of bed, why we can't get our homework finished, why we can't go to work, whatever it is, right? You guys have been around people that are like this. You've heard their excuses and you roll your eyes and think, well, the rest of society figures a way how to function even when there's a lion in the open street, right? There's a lot of people out of bed right now that are getting work done, okay? So let this not mark any of us as a quality, all right? So no excuses. Get it done. No, and that's the reality of it, right? Now, we read, or we will read, in David's day, right, there were lions in Israel, there were bears, you know, we saw Samson. So they're in the land, but it's like, really? Like, yeah, no, it's not a common problem. It's akin to us saying the same thing. No, there's probably a lion in the Clovis Square. I couldn't possibly go, right? Like, really? So, no. There you go. There's a large cat. So, there you go. All right, so no excuses. Moving on. Back to Genesis. Where are we? 1 Samuel. Get out of bed. See my face waggling my finger. Get up. It's hard. I'm with you guys. This is the hard time of year. Daylight saving time kicks you in the face, right? It's starting to get light outside, and all of a sudden someone turns off the lights again. It's not cool. This is the hard time of year. So keep pressing forward, okay? March, April, it's tough. Spring break, coming back from spring break. And I go, I just want to be done. I'm so sick of Mike. Speaking of, what just happened? Speaking of so sick of Mike, we have something we need to talk to you about. It's called an intervention. Okay, gotcha.
Do we have a week after spring break in
the You do.
When is it?
I don't know. That's a lot to remember. It's not next week.
It's the week of Easter, right?
It says the 24th.
24th is the Sunday, so 25th through the 29th. You guys are off. Yes. 25th through the 29th. Dude, check that. Nope. Yep. Well, I'm wondering why I don't have residency on Tuesday, April 2nd.
You're not here on Tuesday.
I know, but I usually put it in my calendar. What? I'm not? The heck you say? No. Yeah, no. So 20. All right, 25th to 29th. That's the week. I couldn't remember if for some reason we may have given you guys two, but y'all don't need to. Y'all fine. You good. All right. Yeah, so 2 weeks. By the way, if you're ever wondering, it's usually consistent with Clovis Unified, so that I'm off when my kids are off, because there's 27 colleges, school districts. It's impossible to try to put spring break within all of them, so CUSD is usually what we follow. Okay, so May 9th, first week of May, something like that. We don't have much left, gang. I think it's actually May 3rd. Yeah, we don't have a lot left, and we got a lot of ground to cover. So on that note, let's cover some ground. First Samuel, okay? Are we all on the same page? Fabulous. All right, we're going to meet Samuel, his kids. We're going to meet Eli, his chump kids. We're going to, yeah, it's an interesting deal, okay? So Samuel's all about monarchy. I prefer the word preparation. But the wonderful smart people who created this chart didn't ask me, so that's all right. But we're preparing David to reign. Okay, so 1 Samuel is about God basically saying, y'all want a king? Great. Who do you want? You want Fabio? Great, I'll give you Fabio. Okay, let's see how Fabio does. Oh, not so good? Okay, then let me pick a king, and we get David. Okay, and all of 1 Sam, the back half of 1 Sam, is all about what God's going to do to get David ready to lead. Okay, he's going to promise him the kingdom, and it's going to be 30 years, 20 years, something like that, before God actually gives him the crown. Okay, so he goes through a long period of hurry up and wait. Okay, so it's going to be fascinating to watch that happen. Okay, we're going to walk through a dark history in Israel today. We're going to lose the Ark of the Covenant, okay, if you can believe that. Israel's going to think we should take it out to battle. It's a lucky rabbit's foot. Let's not actually pray to God. Let's just use our lucky rabbit's foot, and God will whoop everybody. God said, no, not so much. I don't work like that. Okay, pretty funny stuff that we're going to see this morning. We'll meet Dagon, the half-fish god of Israel, or of Israel. Well, probably worshipped by Israel, too, the Philistines, so there's Dagon. I did that this morning. You're welcome. Thank you, Wikipedia. Yes, so there's Dagon, half-fish, half-man, so fertility god of the Philistines, so... All right, so monarchy is fine, but I think preparation to lead for David is probably the theme of it. And we're going to meet Saul, obviously, this morning as well, who's going to be their first king. He does all right to begin with, but then is a miserable failure, so quickly. So, all right, so let's dive in. Somebody pray for us, and then we will get into 1 Sam. Who shall pray? Mitch wants to pray. Thank you, Mitch. Yes, God told me. Hopefully, truth would be good. Hopefully, Mike doesn't say anything heretical again. Maybe we can get some truth today. All right. I'm going to trust your heart on that one, Mitch. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt because I like you. All right. So, 1 Sam, chapter 1, verse 1. Let's pick up there.
There was a certain man of...
Yep, you get the fun names.
...of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah.
Okay, Elkanah, that's the guy you need to know. Verse 2, he's got two wives. Okay, one was Hannah, who you know. Okay, Hannah's pretty cool. And Peninnah, okay, or Peninnah, I guess is how you say her name. One has kids, fruitful womb. The other, Hannah, does not. No kids, all right? So Hannah is a very godly woman. We're going to see this. So that day and age again, what's going on? If you got a man with two wives and one has got kids and one has not got kids, what would you assume is happening? What's that? Something's happening, right? What's the stigma that would be on Hannah? It's no bueno, right? You don't have kids. Okay, this other woman's cranking out kids like, you know, she's got a ton, all right? The other one doesn't. So we've seen that tension before between kids and no kids and wives and all the way back to the patriarchs, right? So Hannah's probably got a stigma about her to not have kids. God's, for whatever reason, shut down her womb. And we're going to see God open her womb. So God's in control of the womb. Okay? Yes, sir. Different dude. We're going to meet some familiar names this morning as well. We're going to meet another Phineas, unfortunately. Next verse. Read verse 3. JD, on that note.
Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and sacrifice the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phineas, were priests of the Lord.
All right, so Shiloh, what's at Shiloh right now? What important? The ark and Tabernacle, okay? That's what's at the ark. Brad went to Shiloh last year. We can't go. It's under Palestinian control. There's not much there. But he basically said, there's nothing there. Like, there's no reason to build a city. There's nothing to see other than the tabernacle used to be there and the ark used to be there. Why they picked Shiloh, I have no idea. But there's nothing externally about the city where you go, that would make a ton of sense. Like, Jerusalem is on a hill and fortified and, oh, it's defensible and, oh, we got water. Shiloh's like, really? It's like Tulare. Like, what? Go to Carmel or go somewhere nice. But why would you build it here? Why Bakersfield? Okay? It's just there. Okay? So anyway. Eli is the priest, and he's got two kids, Hophni and Phineas. Okay? Poor guy. Phineas, this guy ruins Phineas' name. So I wish that Eli would have picked a different name for his kid. Different Phineas. And he is on the opposite side of the spectrum of our boy Phineas from Numbers and the like, okay? So, this family, Hannah and her husband, Elkanah, go to Shiloh every year to worship God, okay? So, see a godly family and godly heritage, okay? Keep going to verse 4.
On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Hanan, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion.
All right, so his favorite wife is Hannah, okay? You can see this guy, he's dumb, but he's got some affection for her. Reminds me of me, right?
I don't know what to say.
But is trying to take care of his wife. God had shut down her womb, and it tells us right there, okay? So she's in a tough spot, okay? Verse 6, her rival is not much more helpful because she would provoke her and irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it's not painful enough that you can't have kids than to have your husband's other wife pointing the finger, making fun of you, is she's cranking out babies left and right, okay? So, difficult spot for this gal to be in, okay? Year after year, they would do the same thing. She would go, she would worship God, she would fast, in verse 7, and she would weep, asking God to open her womb. But God said, no, or not yet. For whatever reason, God would not change the situation. Verse 8, Elkanah would say to her, this is a great guy's verse. This is like a famous one that I could quote to my wife right here. Great intent, bad follow through. Hey, am I not better than you? Like 10 kids? Honey, I'm awesome. You don't need kids, right? He's trying so hard, but he's just a little dumb. So a lot in common with this guy. So there you go. Good intentions, right? So they go every year, they worship. Okay, her womb's closed. Her rival's having kids, and that's the situation. Okay, verse 9, this is the yearly scene. Okay, they would go to Shiloh. Eli the priest, whose two sons are Hophni and Phineas, okay, is watching this woman worship. She's at their tabernacle in verse 9. She's distressed in verse 10. She's praying to God and she's weeping bitterly. Okay, so that's the situation. And you get the idea that this is a yearly ritual for her. She goes, she prays, she begs God to change her situation. And unfortunately, God doesn't. Okay, verse 11, this is the prayer. Here's a great example of the Nazirite vow. This is where people get before they make the vow. Okay, verse 11. Stephanie, read that.
And she made a vow, saying, O Lord Almighty, if you will look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son,
So she makes a commitment. If God, if you will give me a kid, he'll be a Nazarite. Okay, so again, the idea of the vow was like, man, I got nothing left. I have nothing else to pray. This is the last opportunity I have. So she says, I will dedicate my kid to you, which means what? Well, we'll see in a second before you answer that. Okay, so obviously the ideas of the Nazarite, you guys are familiar with those requirements. She's going to take it a step further. Okay, came about as she continued praying that Eli, okay, the priest, was watching her. Verse 13, Hannah was speaking with her heart, but her lips were moving, but she wasn't making any noise. Okay, verse 13, what does Eli think? She's drunk, which is funny. So here you have the priest who isn't quite sure what a praying woman who's moving her mouth and yet not making any words looks like. Does that seem odd to you? That the priest would be like, gosh, that looks odd. Like, what is that? She must be drunk. Like, no, it's called prayer, dude. You're the priest. Like, hello? Like, it just seems odd to me that he can't put that together. She's at the tabernacle. They come here every year. She's heartbroken. She's barren. She's praying. She's not making noise. She's moving her lips, and you think she's drunk. So, odd. So he comes to her and rebukes her. Okay, good job. Okay, 14. How long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine. Right, 14. 15. Hannah says, "No, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord." Okay, I'm just begging God to provide here. Do not consider your maidservant a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation. So, like, I'm just hurting. So, not drunk. And Eli goes, "Oh." Okay, go in peace. May the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked him. So whatever you ask God, then okay. So may he grant that. Verse 18, what does she say? Stephanie, pick up there.
She said, "May your servant find favor in your eyes." Then she went away and
ate
something, and her face was no longer downcast.
Okay, now Hannah's one of those sneaky heroes, okay? She's in a very difficult situation, right? Barren, hard, begging God to provide. Year after year, God does nothing. And not just nothing, like there's no answer to her prayer. It's like, hello, God, are you there? She repeatedly asked, and God just, there's just silence, right? You guys ever had those moments where you're praying and you're looking at the ceiling and you're like, hello? God, are you here? Are you existent? Do you hear anything I'm doing right now? I'm begging you, I'm hurting, and you get nothing, right? Painful situation, okay? Notice in 18 what changes. Why? Talk to me about that. Have her circumstances changed? No. Is she now cranking out kids? No. But her whole perspective on it changed, right? Lord, this is yours. Put it in your hands. I can't do anything. I can't stress about it. I can't fret. I can't, like, this is not going to accomplish anything. So I'm going to choose to be joyful in the midst of a crummy situation, and that's my choice. I may not be happy about it. I want kids. I don't have them, okay? Made that clear, but I'm not going to let this ruin my life, okay? So her attitude and perspective changes before the circumstance ever does. Is God going to bring her kids? Absolutely. We know the story, but I think God wanted something out of her first, which was, give it to me, walk away, change your perspective, and then let's see what happens, okay? So she does that, verse 19, let's see what happens.
Then they rose early in the morning and worshipped before the Lord and returned again to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah and it had relations with it, Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her.
The Lord remembered her, right? And it came about in due time that she conceived. She gave birth to a son and named him Samuel. What does Samuel mean? Anybody know? Got a note? Heard from God or asked of God, right? So we asked of God, God provided. So he provided what we asked for, okay? So because I have asked of the Lord, okay? Now, she has a whole nother level of commitment about her. So not only is Samuel going to be a Nazarite, but she is basically going to say, God, thank you. I am now giving this kid back to you, okay? He's going to be an inherited priest to Eli. He's going to become one of Eli's basically sons. She's literally going to send this kid to go live in Shiloh away from home with Eli and his two bozo sons, Hophni and Phinehas, okay? So The man Elkanah went up to the household, verse 21, to yearly offer sacrifices and to pay his vow. Hannah did not go up. She says, I will not go until the child is weaned, and then I will bring him that he may appear before the Lord and stay forever. Okay, that's her plan. So I will get done weaning this kid, which is anywhere from 2 to maybe the high side of that day would be 5. But that's the idea. So, yeah, which is odd. So, but that day and age, it wasn't as weird as it would be to see a 5-year-old breastfeeding today. Okay. So that was the idea. So I'm going to wean this kid, and then God, I'm going to commit him to you. He's yours. Okay. So that's the plan. Okay. Elkanah says, verse 23, hey, do what seems best to you. If that's the commitment you've made to God, then we're going to give up our kid. They are from Ephraim. He's going to be not a priest. He's going to be more of a prophet. So not a Levitical priest, but he's going to study underneath the priest. So he is going to be he's going to be about the only bright shining hope within the land because he studies underneath Eli. Eli's great, okay? Eli's got issue with his kids whose kids aren't great, okay? And you're going to see like father, like son, okay? He's going to learn some bad lessons from Eli's example, okay? So that's the idea, all right? Verse 24, she took him, weaned him, took a 3-year-old bull. Verse 24, brought him to the house of Shiloh. They make a sacrifice. In verse 27, listen to this prayer.
For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition which I asked of him. So I have also dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there.
Okay, that's always fascinated me, that statement. A couple things we'll mention here, but... how hard would that be, is Hannah, to give away your kid, right? Is there any greater hope that she had in life than to have a kid? That's all she wanted, right? And she gets it, and she says, God, okay, I'm going to trust you, and I feel like I need to give him back to you. So she does. So this kid's probably 2 or 3 years old at this point. And what does it say of him? End of verse 28.
He worshiped
the Lord there. At 3? Like, what does that look like? You guys ever seen a 3-year-old worship? I don't know. But what does that tell you about how this kid's been brought up? That's impressive, right? Before Michelle and I got married, she lived with a family in their home. They had, at the time, 2 kids. They now have 5, and they've adopted a couple. But she lived in their home. They're really, really cool couple. And when we were a part of that life stage for them, they had an 18-month-old kid named Micah, okay? Really cool kid. And this kid, just because of the example of his mom and dad, when they would sit down to pray at dinner, he didn't say a lot, but he knew how to pray. He put his hands together. He understood. Like, he just mimicked what he saw around him, right? And I don't know what his faith was like as an 18-month-old, but you would imagine a kid that was not much older than that has just watched his parents, and he's grown up in a godly home, and he's seen that from the beginning. And there's a sense that already at this age, this kid knows how to worship because of the example set by mom and dad. So this kid's got a great start, okay? So Samuel, is a stud, all right? Chapter 2, this is Hannah's song, okay? Similar to the song that Miriam sang as they crossed the Red Sea. She sings out to God and basically just declares her thanks, talks about who God is, how wonderful she's been blessed, all those sorts of things. So 2:1-10 is basically her song, okay? So that's that. We won't read through all of it, but she makes a profound heart cry to God and thanks him for who he is, right? Let's pick up in verse 11, and let's watch kind of the fleshing out of this story and what's happening now. So someone pick up at 2:11.
Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy ministered to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest.
Keep going.
Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord.
All right, so you've got the high priest of the nation, okay, and the 2 sons that are described here as worthless, and they do not know the Lord. Okay, so they're not Christians in our sense, but they're doing the job of the JV priest, okay, because their dad is the high priest. One of these guys would have been in line to be the next priest of Israel, okay, the high priest of Israel, okay? And this is what they do, okay? Just keep reading through 13 and following, and this is what makes them, part of what makes them worthless.
The custom of the priest with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a 3-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there.
So does this sound like what we read in Leviticus as to how the priests were supposed to eat the sacrifice, just stick a fork in the boiling... I mean, they're going about this all wrong, first of all. And they were basically cheating the system. They were there to eat, and they were there to go make money off of the money and basically surplus for themselves. Okay, that was their attitude. Like, this is for me. So we're going to take your hard-earned stuff that you're bringing to offer to God, and we're going to cheat you in the process so that we can eat and that we can take care of ourselves. Okay. Verse 15, before they burn the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give the priest meat for roasting, and he will not take boiled meat for you, only raw. So that was wrong. Okay. They would take it before they had burned the fat off it in verse 16. And they would go so far to say, if you tell me no, then I will take it from you by force. Like, these guys were, like, what option do they have? You're the priest, okay? Dad's high priest, you're JV, I don't have anywhere else to go. Like, it was just a corrupt system, okay? So, again, coming off the book of Judges, not a surprise that this is the spiritual condition of the land, okay? So, bad deal. Samuel, by the way, is going to be our final judge, if you will, okay? So, the end of the line of judges is going to end with Samuel, who's going to be the last judge before we get our first king in Saul, all right? Now, the flip side of this is 18, okay? Read that.
Samuel was ministering before the Lord. The boy clothes were withered ephod.
So he's being brought up like a priest. He's not going to be one, but he's going to fulfill that role. He's going to watch, okay? So you've got these two older kids that are an absolute moral meltdown, and then you've got Samuel, who's being raised by Eli, okay, and he's pouring into him. This kid has a heart for God, and he's learning how to be basically a godly man for this older, seasoned godly man, okay, who basically is his father, okay? Funny verse 19, read that. So every year this guy would get a change of clothes, he'd get a new linen ephod to wear. Okay, mom would bring it. She would see him once a year when she came to sacrifice at Shiloh, bring this kid his next linen ephod, right? And he would wear that all year and grow out of it, right? Started at his ankles and now it's up at his knees and he'd get another one, all right? So that's how Hannah now got to see her kid. So you got this godly little kid who's growing up. He's blessed, okay? And that's how the interaction would go. Verse 22, here's the growing issue with Eli's kids.
Now Eli was very old. They kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel. Now they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting.
Oof, like this is bad. Lay with the women who were serving at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Okay, so first of all, these kids are having relations with prostitutes who shouldn't be at the doorway of the tent of meeting in the first place. So where do they get that custom from? What does that tell you about the spiritual condition of Israel right now? They're borrowing from all the other pagans around them that's what was normative in their worship service. So that's what they're doing. So they are sleeping with women on the church doorsteps at the front entrance. Like, wow, that is just high-handed rebellion, right? Eli comes to them and says in verse 23, why do you do such evil things, the evil things that I hear from the people? What's going on? Okay. No, my sons, the report in verse 24 that I hear is not good. Okay. 25, he says, if one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede? Meaning, dude, your job is to mediate for the people, right? If one man sins against God, they got a mediator, right? A go-between. You are the go-between. Like, we got a problem, right? The mediator is broken. Okay. So end of verse 25, haunting statement. Read 25.
If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death.
Wow. So God's upset, okay, and rightfully so. And the antithesis of that, verse 26, read that. So these two stories are just juxtaposed. These horrible, awful kids of Eli, right? Hophni and Phinehas that are just blowing it. And then you get this young kid who's from nowhere, from a Nazarite vow, from a woman who was barren, given to God, and is growing in favor and stature of the Lord. Okay, so this guy is on fire, literally. So he's doing great things for God. Okay, so these two stories are meant to kind of be juxtaposed, if you will. Okay, 27, we find out more about these kids. If you guys have ever read or seen the movie Chariots of Fire, this was a verse that was brought up in the midst of that movie that was kind of cool for Eric Little and his decision not to run on a Sunday to honor God, okay? Pick up in... Sorry.
In Luke 2:52, it almost quotes like that same thing that says Jesus.
Yeah.
Was that written like that on purpose?
Probably, yeah. There's probably some carryover from what this was at that type of age. So Eli's... Samuel's not quite the age that Jesus was, that was mentioned of him. He was closer to, Jesus was 12, 13 at that time, going into the temple. He's a little bit younger. But you're seeing, which is interesting about Samuel, his reputation is growing around town, which is fascinating at this age, okay? God is pushing back on these two boys. Pick up in verse, JD, pick up in verse 29, and let's see what he's saying about these kids and what's happening.
Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded for my dwelling? And honor your sons above me by fattening yourself on the choicest parts of every offering of my people of Israel. Therefore the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promise that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed.
So he basically said, look, I promised a perpetual priesthood from this house, okay? But no, because your kids are so awful, I'm taking it away. I am going to transfer the priesthood to another family, family of Zadok, we're going to see in 1 Kings. God's going to transfer the priesthood. Still be through the Levites, but the sub-family that continues to carry that torch is going to change because of the sin in Eli's family with Hophni and Phinehas, okay? So God basically says, look, there's going to be a dark day. Days are coming, verse 31, that it's going to get real bad. 34, here's the sign that you'll know that I've taken the priesthood away. Evan, read that in 34.
And this that shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be a sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day.
I'm going to kill them both, same day. God says, that's when you're going to know it's really, it's bad, okay? But, verse 20, or 35, rather, keep going.
And now I raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my name forever.
Okay, so there's going to be a new line that's going to walk with God, okay? And we're going to see that fulfilled through a number of lines with David and Jesus ultimately, that we're going to see the Davidic covenant coming in 2 Samuel, okay? Give me some observations just about, and I think Brad beat on this pretty good in our journey through 1 Samuel, but just about Eli and his kids and the job that he's got. What would you expect from a guy like that? You probably wouldn't expect kids that are like an absolute nightmare, right? Walk me through that. What's going on? What would you guess is happening? You wonder if his priorities were a little bit jacked, right? Is he doing a good job as a priest himself? Seems like it, right? He's a godly dude. He loves, in his context, Jesus, God, right? So he's doing a good job, but his kids are a nightmare, right? It's fascinating to me that Samuel is going to have the exact same problem with his kids, okay? His two kids are going to be so ungodly that the nation's going to go, we want a king. Your kids, we see what's coming. If they're in line after you die, we want no part of that. Please give us a king. That's what's going to cause them to cry out and say, we don't care what the consequences are of a king. Taxes, taking, why? Great, as long as it's not your kids. So it's interesting to me that that was the habit that was learned from Eli that got passed down to Samuel. Okay, so I think at times there's that spectrum of work and family, and in different seasons it swings back and forth. These guys, I think, were a little bit too far over on the work side. I've seen the pendulum swing too far over to the family side and family become an altar that we bow down to. And so there needs to be a balance there. And I don't know exactly what that looks like in terms of how you navigate that as a guy with three daughters and trying to be at soccer games and gymnastics and school stuff and art shows and work. And it gets complicated. It is not super easy to do. But his first priority was his kids, right? And he needed to be a priest to God, and those were the right things. But boy, my first priority in life is not the well. My first priority in life is not off the front. My first priority in life is my wife, my relationship with God, and my family. And after that comes those things, right? And that needs to be put in perspective in how we spend our time. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we spend more time in one than the other, but that priority is certainly elevated, okay? And those rub against each other, too. That's hard. I'm missing a soccer game on Saturday because of work. Well, it is what it is, right? So you got to figure that out. So anyway, but just unfortunate reality that these guys live in, okay? So Samuel's going to live in the aftermath of watching a dad that didn't do a great job as a dad, and he's going to pass that unfortunate tradition all the way down to his sons, okay? Now, chapter 3, we're going to see Samuel grow, okay? So let's watch this kid and what God's beginning to do in him. 3:1.
Now the young man Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision.
Why would that be? Because it's dark spiritually, right? So God doesn't speak much because they're worshiping other gods, okay? Eli is old, okay? The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and that Samuel was lying down in the temple. So they're getting ready to go to sleep at night. Ark of God is there, and God speaks directly to Samuel. Okay, verse 4, the Lord called Samuel, and he said, "Here I am." Okay, Samuel has never heard God audibly speak to him in his life. Okay, verse 5, this is his reaction. This is probably what all of us would do. So he runs to Eli and says, "You called me?" He said, "No, I didn't call you. Go back to bed." Okay. Verse 6, the Lord called out again and says, "Samuel." Samuel arose, goes to Eli, "Here I am." But he answered, "I did not call you. Lie back down." Like, dude, what's going on? Go back to bed, right? Sounds like one of my kids who just wants to stay up for 15 minutes later than I, you know, right? Just, "What did you say, Dad?" "I didn't say anything. Go back to sleep," right? Now the third time, God calls Samuel, and Eli realizes, huh, something's going on. This kid's just not trying to get milk and cookies, right? Eli discerned, end of verse 8, that the Lord was calling the boy. He's speaking to him. So he gives him some instructions. Verse 9, I'm going to keep reading that.
Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down, and if he calls you, you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant hears.'" So Samuel went and laid down in his place.
All right, so he recognizes God's got something to tell you. You just ask him what it is, okay? Keep going.
And the Lord came and stood, calling as at other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant hears." Then the Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel at which the two ears of everyone hears it will tingle."
Okay, meaning this is going to be a big deal, and it's not going to be good. Okay, keep going.
"On that day, I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end, and I declare to him that I'm about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew because his sons were blaspheming God, and he did not restrain them. Therefore, I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned by the sacrifice or offering forever."
Ouch. Like, that is not a good message, okay? And this is basically your dad. God just delivered this message to you saying, "I'm about to punk your dad, and more so his kids, because of the evil, and no amount of sacrifice is going to fix this. I am done," okay? Samuel went down, okay? He opened the doors of the house of the Lord. Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to to Eli, right? Which is pretty natural. I wouldn't want to communicate. That's a hard message. So this boy's first job is to cut it clean, right? Here's what God said. I don't care if you like it, right? I love you, Eli, but boy, this is it, okay? So welcome to being a heralder of the gospel in a dark age. This is what the word of God says, right? I'm not here to make sure you like it and to sugarcoat it, make sure it comes across okay. It's like, man, this is what it says, right? So, you know, we need to love people in that process, but he's got a tough first job, okay? And basically, Eli says, "Listen, I need to hear what he said," okay? And he says, "All right, this is what he said." Verse 18 told him everything and chooses not to hide anything from him. Samuel's response, or Eli's response, is, "It is the Lord, let him do what seems good to him." That's from God. And if that's what's going to come, which he just heard, your two sons are going to die on the same day. And God's about to bring it out. rough, okay? Verse 19 again, here are the bookmarks that we begin to see about this kid. Read 19 and 20.
Thus Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fail. All Israel, from Dan to even to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again to Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord.
That's the first time we see these boundary markers in 20. Remember, Dan to Beersheba. Okay, Dan has now moved north. They're all the way up on the north side of Israel. Beersheba is the southern border city. And they're saying, basically, that's the new boundary markers from north to south. So the breadth and the width of Israel, everybody knows who Samuel is. So he is growing, and his reputation has preceded him. So this guy is kind of he's a big deal, and people know he is the bright shining hope for Israel, because Hophni and Phinehas surely are not. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, now we're going to transition. We've met this young boy who's growing. Chapter 4, now we're going to turn our attention to the ongoing battle between Israel and the Philistines, all right? So, somebody pick up in 4, verse 1, and we'll take a look at what's going on.
And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Ephek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle.
All right, so here we're at, okay? So just to give you some perspective, we're in the Shephelah, right? Here's Aphek right here in Ebenezer. So to give you some perspective, Jerusalem is right here, okay? So they're up north, they're fighting, again, in the Shephelah, and they're about to go to battle right here, okay? So notice what happens, verse 2. What's the initial outcome of the battle? Israel loses 4,000 men. Why would you guess that's the case? Not following God. So God's like, great, I'm not winning these battles for you. 4,000 men die, okay? So they're like, huh, brilliant idea. Verse 3, Mitch, keep going.
And when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today for the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the people of our power of our enemies.
So what do you notice with that? What's their idea?
They're just gonna bring God in the suitcase.
Yeah. Let's get the suitcase. Let's bring it out. And be like, take that, right? It's the Indiana Jones idea, right? Are we gonna pray? Are we gonna repent? Are we gonna tell God we're sorry for worshiping, you know, fish god Dagon and all the other gods that we've been worshiping, and Hophni and Phinehas sleeping on the church steps? No. Let's just get the rabbit's foot, okay? They make sense here. They don't make sense here, right? And that's the most difficult journey in the world, right? And they're not there yet, okay? And here's where it goes bad. So they're like, great, let's get it, okay? Get the ark, okay? The Philistines hear about it. They're like, ooh, we're dead, okay? Verse 6, it says they understood that the ark had come up from the camp of the Israelites, and they freak out. They realize, dude, this is bad for us, okay? Verse 8, this is what they say. So they don't necessarily know who their gods are, but they know, yeah, we've heard about this guy all the way back to Egypt. Like, if they're bringing him out, we're in trouble, okay? Verse 9, they get their own Mel Gibson speech, okay? Take courage, men, O Philistines, or you will become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight, right? Suck it up. Get out of your beds. Quit making excuses. Go read Proverbs, right? He said, we're going to go fight, okay? Verse 10, the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent, and the slaughter was great. And there fell of Israel 30,000 people. So we have lost now 34,000 people in battle. In verse 11, what else happens?
And the ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died.
Ouch, that is a lot going on in that verse. Ark gets captured. This is the first time in Israel's history that they've lost the ark. That's a bad, bad day, okay? And Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, as God predicted, died on the same day. Okay, so news travels back now to Eli. We find out in verse 15 that he is 98 years old. His eyes were set so that he could not see. He's old, he's blind, cataracts or what have you. He can't see anymore. A guy comes back from battle. Verse 16, he says, how did things go? Verse 17, the guy gives him the report and says, hey, Philistines came in, We got spanked. Hophni and Phinehas are dead, and the Ark of the Lord has been taken. Like, that's a whole lot of bad news. By the way, your life's work is over, okay? Ark's gone, and your two sons are dead. So everything that you live for, gone. Verse 18, this is his response.
As soon as he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell over backwards from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy.
It's fascinating what causes this dismay in him. What is the thing that causes him to fall over? The Ark, not his kids, all right? You would think, the kids would be, I don't know. It's not a statement of importance. It tells you where his priorities were, which are right, right? He's grieved deeply for the fact that the Ark of God is gone, because that's a sign of, boy, is bad, okay? So that's the idea, all right? Now, you guys remember names in the Bible and how funny these are, okay? Verse 19, Phinehas' wife was pregnant, okay? She gives birth to a kid. Verse 21, this is what they named the kid.
And she named the child Ichabod, saying the glory has departed from Israel.
That's a rough name, right? So you talk about why people name, like, yeah, it is a dark day in Israel. Your name is Ichabod, which means God is gone. He has left the building. He is no longer here, right? So that was, again, we've talked about those significances, the significance of names. This kid gets named for one of the darkest periods in Israel. The Ark is gone. God is gone. We're in sin. Verse 22, the glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God was taken. Okay, so dark, dark day. Now, 5, 6, and 7 are humorous. Okay, here is Israel trying to take their lucky rabbit's foot into battle, let God fight for them. And God's like, look, man, I can handle myself, okay? So the Ark gets taken. Everyone's in panic. What's God going to do, right? God can take care of God, okay? So 5 verse 1, pick up there.
Now the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it to the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon.
All right, so they're at Ashdod, which again is their Philistine city on the coast. This is where their temple tabernacle would have been, okay, and the prime deity in their house at this time was Dagon. Okay, that's Dagon, fish god. Okay, fertility god, just like the rest of them. Okay, agriculture and fish. You know, obviously on the sea they had fish incorporated to what they would have done. So that's a depiction of their god. Okay, so they set the Ark of God next to Dagon in their place of worship. Okay, they're pantheists, so they're like, whatever. Okay, we worship everybody and everything. So Dagon was one of many gods, so throw Israel's God in there as well, and let's see what happens. Verse 3.
When the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set him in his place again.
Huh, so Dagon is now bowing before the Ark of the Lord. That's weird. He's just fallen down, right, and he's laying prostrate before the Ark. Odd. 4, let's set him back up, okay? What happens the next day?
Morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left.
So now he's lying down on his face worshiping God, and he's lost his hands, right? So again, humorous. Can God take care of himself? Yeah, he's going to take care of himself, and it's going to get funnier, okay? So they panic now, like, oh gosh, this was not just some random whatever, not, you know, some gust of wind came through the temple and knocked Dagon over. They realized this is something weird going on. So verse 5, this is what they do.
Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to this day.
All right, sorry, 6. Keep going.
Okay. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories.
All right. Anybody got a different translation in verse 6 for tumors? Yeah. Quite possibly hemorrhoids, which is funny, right? So whatever it is, they've got some nasty skin ailment that they realize, boy, this is bad. As soon as this thing rolled into town, that Ark, the Ark's the problem, okay? We all got tumors. Get rid of the Ark, okay? So when the men of Ashdod saw that it was the case, they said, man, we need to hand this over. Hand is severe on us and on Dagon, our God. So verse 8, They gathered all the lords of the Philistines and say, what do we do? And they said, you know what? Let's send the ark somewhere else. Okay? They don't send it back to Israel. They're going to now share their tumors with their friends. Okay? So, way to be good sharers. So they are in Ashdod, okay, and they're going to say, verse 8, let's send it to Gath, okay? So here's Gath over here, okay? So they sent the ark to Gath, okay? Verse 9 came about after they had brought it to Gath that the city, that the hand of the Lord was on the city in very great confusion. He smote the men of the city, both young and old, so that they had tumors, okay? So Gath's like, boy, thanks a lot. Then they're going to go to Ekron, okay? So Ekron is just north of Gath, so they send it now here, okay? Same thing happens. They break out in tumors and like, boy, this is just not some random thing. Maybe it needs to get returned to Israel. So that's their idea. Okay. Verse 11, read that. Yeah, so now God's got three cities that, you know, no one from Israel's there. It's just God. He's taking care of himself, and everybody's got hemorrhoids, okay? And they're like, boy, this is bad, okay? 6 verse 1, they say, all right, here's what we're going to do, okay? We need to send it back, but if you send it away empty-handed, then we're kind of like not honoring their God, okay? So verse 3, they say, we need to give a guilt offering. We need to provide something in return. Yeah. I don't know. Probably because of the tumors. We're going to see it get open here in a minute. Not by the Philistines, but from Israel, okay? And dudes are going to die. But for whatever reason, it appears that they didn't, so.
I just feel like, you know, you go into battle, you get this box, and you're like, oh, it's inside.
Right. I would imagine, based on what's happened to their God and their bodies, that they don't want anything to do with it. So I think, like, if we got hemorrhoids from just being around it, opening it probably would be worse. So it seems like they didn't, but we don't know. So they realize they need to make a guilt offering. Okay, verse 4. This maybe is probably one of the most interesting things fashioned of gold in your Bible. Jenna, read that in lieu of your hemorrhoid observation.
And they said, what is the guilt offering that we shall return him? They answered, 5 golden tumors.
Okay, so they make golden mice, okay, and they make golden what else? Tumors. So whatever disease they were afflicted with, now they made golden representations of those. So here you go. It's a golden hemorrhoid. Congratulations, right? So whether it was that, whether it was some skin, we don't know, but that's what they decided would appease God, okay? So you know what? You're making a good effort. So at this point, you're a little bit more spiritual than Israel is right now, because at least you're trying to do something that's going to honor God and, you know, whatever. God's going to accept it, okay? So that's what they do, all right? Make those tumors, golden tumors, golden mice, so that God gets out of here and quits ravaging our land. Verse 7, here's the plan as to how they're going to deliver it back to Israel. Read that. Erica, read that. Mm-hmm. All right, so you're going to take two, mine says milch cows, so these are mama cows that have just had young, okay? Put them underneath a yoke that, by the way, they've never been yoked in their life. They have no idea what this is like and what it feels like. Send them one way and take their calves another, okay? Now, what would normally a mama cow do in that situation? Going straight back to her babies, right? Okay, so they're playing this out for a reason to say, okay, watch verse 9. If it goes up by the way of our own territory to Beth Shemesh, then he is gone, then he is going to do this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that this was not his hand that struck us. Meaning, the normative thing would be for the cows to come back, and if that's what happens, come back to our territory, because they're coming back to their young, we're good. If not, this really has been God, and if these cows somehow miraculously go away from their young and go into Beth Shemesh, which is in Israel's territory, then we know this is a miracle. This is the hand of God against us. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, verse 10, that's what they do. Verse 11, they put the ark of God on the cart, okay, in the box of the golden mice and the likeness of their tumors, right? Now, how do we transport the ark? Is this how we do it? No. But these are Philistines, so God's like, whatever. I'm getting golden tumors out of the deal, so whatever, okay? So he knows that they don't read the Levitical law, so he's like, fine, okay? So verse 12, they put the cart, the cows, yoke the cows, put the ark on the cart, head it towards Bet Shemesh, okay? So here we are in Ekron. This is the last city they were in, and they're going to send the ark just out through the Sorek Valley to Bet Shemesh, okay? Who is our friend that is from Bet Shemesh? House of the Sun. We studied him in Judges. Samson, okay? So this is Samson's home. This is the old Danite land, okay? This is where Samson would have lived, right in that area, okay? So they go out, okay? Verse 12, let's watch what happens.
And the cows went straight in the direction of Bet Shemesh, along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right nor to the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Bet Shemesh.
So where do the cows go? To Israel, to Bet Shemesh, right? So not in the normative direction that they should have gone. They should have turned home and went to their cow or their calves, right? Philistines walk basically behind them, watch this go down. The cart comes into verse 14, Bet Shemesh, okay, to this guy named Joshua. The cart comes in, they split wood of the cart, they offer the cows immediately as a burnt offering to God. So they realize, holy cow, literally, holy cow, there they are. Offer the cart. That's the ark of God. Like, it's just walking itself right back home, okay? So that had to be a fascinating sight, okay? Verse 15, now watch what happens.
And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it.
Okay, now, Bet Shemesh would have been a Levitical city, so Levites are there. They take properly the ark off of the cart. They make more sacrifices to the Lord right there on the spot. The lords of the Philistines see this and go, boy, yeah, God ravaged us. Okay, this is our bad. Okay. Now, problem is, the men of Israel decide they want to take a peek into the ark of God. So, Evan, read that. Watch what happens to them. Okay, anybody got a different number in verse 19? All of you have 70? Okay, I have 50,070, okay? Which is the first time ever, okay? I'll admit it publicly. Mine's probably wrong, okay? The idea would be in the Septuagint, which was one of the original translations of the Old Testament, the number was originally 70, and I think that's probably a copyist error. So there weren't 50,000 people in Bet Shemesh, and when we get there, you realize, yeah, probably not. So 70 men apparently look in this thing, and God kills them dead, right? So he gives the Philistines some grace. You know what? Put it on a cart, pull it by cows, whatever. Okay, y'all are at least trying to honor me. Your hearts are right. They come in, and now they want to take a peek into the ark, like what's in there, and God kills them instantly. Okay, so 70 men die for looking into the ark. Okay. Now, as a result of this, they think, oh, boy, okay, who is able, verse 20, to stand before God, this holy God, and whom shall go up for us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath Yearim, saying, the Philistines have brought back the ark to the Lord. Come down and take it, okay? We don't want anything to do with it. 70 men just died. We got to have 70 funerals tomorrow. We don't want to mess with this thing, okay? So Bet Shemesh, again, is here. Kiriath Yearim, which means... City of the Forest is right here. Okay, beautiful area. We'll go there when we go to Israel. Gorgeous. Ladies, that's like all of you want to get married. Okay, it's gorgeous. Okay, that's where they send the ark. Okay, verse 1 of chapter 7, last verse really of chapter 6. Read that. This is how it goes down. Keep reading.
And the men of Kiriath Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of
Abinadab
on the hill, and they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the ark of the Lord.
So we're going to find out, okay, verse 2, we're going to pick up on the story 20 years later. And we're going to find out by the time it finally makes it back to its rightful place, it's basically been sitting in Abinadab's house for 80 years. Like, they're like, yeah, that's our coffee table. It's right over there, right? You know, put your soda on it. Use a coaster. But that's the idea. So they're like, we don't want anything to do with this, right? Send it over there. Why they picked Kiriath Yearim, I don't know. It's up on a hill, so it's kind of out of the way. So I think they just wanted it gone. And they didn't know what to do with it. So, like, look, God's showing his power. We don't want anything to do with it. So they send it away, okay? And Abinadab is the guy that takes it, and it's basically been in his house for 80 years before it comes back. And we'll find out in 2 Samuel why it finally makes it home to its rightful place, okay? But 80 years it sits there, okay? Now, 7:1 to 7:2, we're going to get a 20-year gap, okay? House of Israel is lamenting. God is still kind of punking Israel, but Samuel, verse 3, is grown. He's godly. Things are picking up in Israel because of this guy. And Samuel now is calling the people to return to God. And this is his speech, 7, verse 3.
And Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your hearts to the Lord, and serve him alone, and he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. So the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Ashtaroth, and served the Lord alone.
All right, so even after this great sight of God killing people and taking care of business, they don't repent. They still continue to worship false gods, and it's Samuel that ultimately has to step in 20 years later and say, people, repent, and they do, okay? That's the message you're going to continue to hear from Samuel, okay? Come back to God, repent of your deeds. He's a stud, okay? And you don't see, he's one of those guys that we don't see sin issues in his life except for kind of the baggage of his kids, and we'll look at that here in a bit. But he is a godly guy that's trying to set Israel straight, okay? And then he says in verse 5, gather all of Israel at Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord on your behalf, okay? They come to Mizpah, verse 6, they're fasting. They confess that they've sinned before the Lord in verse 6. Philistines heard that these guys were coming to Mizpah, and they think they're coming for battle, okay? So just to get an idea geographically where we're at, this is, we're going to find out in a bit, Samuel was like a circuit preacher, like old school 1800s in America. He would just go on the road and preach revival. Okay, Gilgal, you guys remember Gilgal when Joshua came to the land? That was home base for them. That's going to be where he's from, and he's just going to make this continual circuit. So he comes to Mizpah, which is right here. Philistines hear about this and say, oh, these guys want to come to battle. And they're like, no, dude, we're just trying to repent and get our junk together, right? So lords of the Philistines come up, and they're ready to fight. They're trying to repent. So we got two different kind of pictures going on. It's a very odd confusing time, okay, especially if you're Israel and you're trying to get right with God and these people want to fight you, okay? So, verse 7, people are afraid of the Philistines as they're coming up to do this, okay? What would have been your natural tendency? If you're Israel and you're coming up to worship God, here come the Philistines, you're about to enter a church service and here are people with their spears and they're ready to fight. What are you going to do? You're going to fight, right? Absolutely, okay? So, verse 8, this is Samuel's response. Like, oh, do something, Samuel. Okay, so this is their answer. Verse 9, keep going.
Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it for a whole burnt offering to the Lord. And Samuel cried to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him.
So, do they get ready to fight? No, Samuel's offering sacrifices, and they're begging him, do something, right? Keep going.
Now Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel.
What a crazy contrast. Philistines are drawing near to battle, and Samuel is offering sacrifices, not telling the people to get ready, not telling them to fight, okay? Sonny, verse 10, watch what God does.
As Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they were defeated before Israel.
Does Israel even lift a hand? No, they just all kill each other, right? God thunders, some great confusion, and they start slaying one another, the men of the Philistines do. Okay, so crazy, but that's how God shows up. Verse 12, Samuel took a stone. Here's this crazy worship song that we sing. Here's where it comes from, okay? Sonny, worship leader, read 12.
Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shin and called its name Ebenezer, for he said, till now the Lord has helped us.
You ever heard that song? We talk about the Ebenezer. You're like, what the heck is an Ebenezer? Okay. What does Ebenezer mean? Anybody got a note on that in their Bible? Yeah, stone of help. What did Samuel just do? What did he create? An altar. An altar of remembrance. Like, God showed up here. He helped us in a day when we were literally about to get walloped by the Philistines. We weren't ready for battle, and God took care of us. So he sets up a memorial to say, people, don't forget this. Okay, so you see Samuel's heart, what he's doing, how he's trying to lead Israel, setting up proper rock piles, basically, okay, to remember what God's done. Okay, the Philistines were subdued, verse 13, they did not come anymore within the border of Israel. So, God saves the day, people have repented, God pushes them back, basically, to the cities that they had taken from Israel, verse 14, and now they're back in Ekron and Gath. Israel delivered them from the hand of the Philistines, okay, or God delivers them from the hand of the Philistines, okay. 15, here we go. This is a statement on kind of Samuel's interaction with the people. Read 15 and 16.
Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah. And he judged Israel in all these places.
All right, so he's a traveling judge at this time, preaching the gospel of repentance to these people. Quit worshiping your stupid false gods and get it right. Okay, so while he's leading, life is good. Okay, problem is what's going on in chapter 8, okay, and what we saw in Eli, the former high priest, we're now going to see in Samuel with his kids. Okay, pick up an 8:1 and let's watch this.
When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba, yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice.
And that is a pretty strong statement, right? So here this guy is ministering, traveling, he's out, he's leading people to repentance, but yet he can't lead his own home, just like Eli, okay? In a strong statement, dishonest gain, took bribes and perverted justice. I'm like, boy, can you, for a judge, can you say a worse thing? You know, these are nasty guys, okay? So, this is kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back for Israel. Verse 4, the elders of Israel came together and said to Samuel, verse 5, read this.
And they said to him, behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge like all the nations.
Okay, that's how bad it is. They look at his kids and say, boy, you're about to die, and we don't want that. That's a dark statement about your kids. That had to be pretty hard for Samuel to swallow, to realize, man, this guy's done a great job. He has turned the entire country, but he couldn't lead his home, okay? Fascinating. What is one of the requirements to be an elder in the church regarding your home?
You have to manage your household.
Yeah. If you can't manage your household, God says, don't bother leading the church, okay? Interesting. That qualification right there would have disqualified Samuel from being an elder in the church because his home was jacked. Okay, that doesn't mean your kids are perfect. It doesn't mean that everything's great. But he has got kids that are ungodly to the degree to which that everyone around them went, wow, like y'all are the poster childs for ungodliness. So God would say, no, focus on them. Let's not lead a country. Okay, why don't you lead your home first? And if you can lead your home well, then maybe that qualifies you to lead a country. Okay, so unfortunate turn of events, okay? So they say, we want a king, okay? Like who? End of verse 5. We want to be like everyone else around us. Give us a king like all the other nations. Samuel said, no. You don't want that. That is not what God wants. So Samuel prays now to God, and God says to him, listen, I told them that they were going to get a king, okay? They were going to reject me, and ultimately, this is exactly what they were going to ask for. Verse 9, this is what God says to Samuel.
Now then, obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them.
So what does God say? They asked for a king. Samuel, what are you to do? Give them a king. Listen to their voice. But before you do, what are you going to do? Warn them. You tell them, okay? Look at verse 11 through 17, okay? Every one of those verses is a description of what the king's going to do. And you'll see repeated in every one of those, take, 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 take. Verse 11, he's going to take your sons and put them in chariots. They're going to be his warriors, okay? Verse 13, he's going to take your daughters for perfumers and bakers and cooks and all these things. Verse 14, he's going to take your fields, your vineyards, the best of your land. He's going to take, verse 15, a tenth of your seed, your vineyard, your produce. He's taking it. Verse 16, he's going to take your male and female servants that are going to become his. He's going to take your donkeys. Verse 17, he's going to take a tenth of your flocks, all the stuff he's going to take. You still want a king? They say, absolutely, give us a king. That sounds wonderful. It sounds better than your two chumpalicious sons, okay, that are sinful and filthy. Okay, so that's a bad day. When that's your description of the king, and they say, no, we want a king. Okay, he says in 18, you're going to cry out on that day, I'm going to give you a king. You're going to say, we want a king. And I'm going to say, no, you don't. And God's going to say, I told you so. And you're going to cry out to God. And God's going to say, uh-uh, that's what you wanted. That's what you got. And they say, no, give us a king anyway in verse 19. Okay, we want to be like all the other nations. We want a king that sits on a throne, that can go out and do battle and look like a real king. We're tired of having this pretend, fake, invisible king that's God. Okay, we want a real guy on a throne. Okay, so God is going to give them exactly what they asked for. Okay, so they're going to get Fabio, first king of Israel. All right. Now, you guys remember we talked about this idea of king earlier. Okay, God knew this was coming, right? When did he talk about this? He told Moses, Deuteronomy 17. I would remember that. Okay. He told them there's a day coming when they're going to ask for a king. And he gave a list of requirements for the king. You guys remember what that was? He couldn't multiply himself. Three things: wives, money, and horses. Okay? So he said, I will give you a king, but these are the rules. Can't have a bunch of Lamborghinis in his garage. Okay? He can't have this huge, you know, bank account in Switzerland. Okay, and he can't have a gazillion wives and concubines. That ain't cool. All right, so that was God's 17. Okay, so let's meet First King of Israel, chapter 9. Read that, verse 1.
There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, son of Bacharoth, son of Apiah, of Benjamin. Benjaminite, a man of wealth.
It's always dangerous to read verse 1 of any chapter, okay? Well done. Okay, he had a son whose name was Saul. Okay, here's the description, ladies, read that.
A handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people.
Okay, here is the quarterback of the football team, ladies, right there. Okay, that's when you saw Saul walk in a room, that was him. Head and shoulders taller than everybody else. There's not a better looking dude. He's a Benjamite. What do we learn about the Benjamites and their ability to fight? They're bad, right? They can throw with both hands. You want to chop off my right? Fine, I'll beat you down with my left hand. Not a problem, okay? So he comes from a tribe that has a great reputation. He's a fighter, or should have been. We'll see that he's not. And he's a good looking, strong, tough, impressive on the outside type of guy. Exactly what Israel wanted, right? I want a king that's going to intimidate all the other kings, okay? So that's what God wasn't good enough, so they got him. Okay, now this isn't Saul's fault per se. You're actually going to see, Saul starts really well. He's a humble guy, obeys his dad. He seems to come from a godly heritage, and he starts really well, okay, as a king. But he blows it pretty fast, okay? So we find out in verse 3, Saul is out on a journey, okay? His dad lost some donkeys. He sends Saul to go find the donkeys, okay? Long story short, he's looking everywhere, can't find his donkeys. He's been on this long journey, and he's like, boy, we're in a bind. We heard of this guy, this seer, that knows things, okay? Samuel. And they said, hey, we need to go find Samuel, this seer, this prophet. He probably knows where the donkeys are. He can tell us. So that's their plan, okay? So verse 6 is a man of God. They hear about this dude, and Saul says now to his servant, man, I'd like to go see this guy, but we got a problem. Verse 7, read that.
Then Saul said to his servant, but behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is gone from our sack, and there is no present to bring to the man or God. What do we have?
You guys remember that proverb that we talked about where a man's gift makes room for him and brings him in front of great men? We weren't talking about a spiritual gift. We were talking about a physical gift. Okay, it's your first impression. What does Saul say here? I like to go see this older, wiser, popular, godly man. But what? I've got nothing to offer him. That would be insulting. So you get an idea that this kid, he grew up in a good family. He understands proper relationships with older people that are respected and revered. I need to bring a gift. I need to come in humility and bring him something. And his buddy says, oh, I got some stuff. We'll bring him this. And he says, okay, now we can go see him. Okay, so he finds out that he's available. They go into the city, find out where he is. God in verse 15 tells Samuel, hey, this kid Saul is coming. Okay, verse 15, about this time tomorrow, 16 rather, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be the very prince over my people Israel. He shall deliver my people from the hands of the Philistines, for I have rejected my people because the cry has come to me. Okay, so Samuel, you're going to meet a dude. His name's Saul. He's looking for donkeys. That's the next king of Israel. So when he comes, anoint him. All right? So they meet, verse 18. Pick up there. So he walks right up to him, has no idea who he is. Hey, do you know where the seer is? Okay, here's Samuel's answer, 19. Okay, so hey, go up to my house. Go up to the high place. I'm going to make a sacrifice, and we're going to eat dinner together. Wow, I just walked up to Obama's house looking for Obama. Didn't know who he was, and he just said, oh, yeah, I'm Obama. We're going to have dinner in the White House tonight, you and me. Okay, like, just one of my donkeys, dude. Okay, 20, and this, what else he tells them?
After your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? It is not for you and for all your father's house.
Hold on real quick. So, what does he just tell them? Saul, you've been 3 days looking for your donkeys. What does Samuel say about them? They're found. Don't sweat it. We took care of it. Okay? They're found. How does Samuel know that? Oh, that's creepy, right? So, so he knows. Did Saul even tell him, hey, I'm looking for donkeys? No. He just comes up and says, do you know where the seer is? I'm the seer. We're going to go have dinner. By the way, your donkeys that you're looking for? Found. Don't sweat it. Okay? And then he says at the end of verse 20, and for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's household? He's saying, I'm going to bless you, basically, is the interpretation of that. 21, Saul hears this, and this is his reaction.
Am I not a Benjamite from the least of the tribes of Israel? Is my clan the humblest of all clans? Is my clan the humblest of all clans? Why then have you spoken to me this way?
What kind of condition is Saul in at this point? What is he saying? Why have you spoken to me in this way?
Dude, you know I'm not anybody.
I'm a nobody from nowhere in a family that's the least and the last. Like, why are you blessing me like this? Okay, so he can't quite get his mind around why Samuel's treating him this way. Okay, they go up to have dinner. Okay, Samuel says to the cook in verse 23, bring the portion that I gave you concerning which I said, set it aside. The cook took the leg that was on it and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, here's what has been reserved. What portion of the, how did the priest eat in that day again? And he would have been a part of this kind of household. Where did their meals come from? From the tithe, right? And they had a specific offering, right, that they got to eat a piece of, okay? They reserved that portion of the offering. And who does Samuel give it to? Saul. He's like, whoa, dude, what is going on, right? He is wigging out, okay? So he eats 26 rather. They rose early, came about at daybreak that Samuel called to Saul and says on the roof, get up that I may send you away. Saul arose and both he and Samuel went out into the street, okay? They go out and in verse 10, or chapter 1 of verse 10 rather, this is what happens. Emily, this one's safe. You can read that. Like, what? No, he hasn't. Like, I'm Saul from Benjamin. Who are you, dude? And he just says, hey, you're going to be prince over Israel. You're the next king, the first king, okay? And he takes this horn of oil, which was how you would anoint somebody, pours it over his head and says, hey, You're the guy, okay? And then he gives them all this prophetic stuff that's going to happen. Okay, keep going in two.
When you depart from me today, you will meet two men by Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin and Selah. And they will say to you, the donkeys that you went to seek are found. And now your father has ceased to care about the donkeys and is anxious about you, saying, what shall I do about my son?
So, like, first I lost donkeys, now I've lost my kids. So, Samuel just tells them, you're going to meet these guys. They're going to tell you this. Verse 3, you're going to go on and you're going to meet some dudes in verse 3 carrying bread. You're going to go on and meet other dudes in verse 5 that are prophets. You're going to prophesy with them. And the Spirit of God is going to be put on you. And the external sign of that is that you're going to have this prophetic utterance, okay? Verse 7, it shall be when these signs come to you, do for yourself what the occasion requires, for God is with you. So he's basically saying, I've anointed you, you're going to be the king, to show that to everyone around you, here are the external things that are going to happen, I'm going to predict the future, here's what's going to happen. He's like, holy cow, this kid's head has to be like spinning right now, right? So, that's the idea, okay? So, verse 9, read that. Okay, gave him another heart mindset. God changed his heart. So basically, God is giving Saul, this young kid, the ability to rule to some degree. Okay, so God's changed his heart. Some people see that as a conversion statement. I don't think that's necessarily what the text is saying. I think he's the Spirit of God has come upon him, and now God is going to use him for a season to rule Israel. Okay, and it's simply that. Okay, so God changes his heart or gives him the ability to lead. Verse 10. Watch this. Keep going. Just as God said, right? You're going to meet these prophets. They're going to be singing and dancing and whatever, and you're going to prophesy with these guys. And people are freaking out going, what? Verse 11, read that.
And when all who knew him previously saw how he had prophesied with the prophets, the people said to one another, what has come over the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?
So they realize, whoa, who's that kid? Like, we know that kid, right? He's not a prophet. So they realize something's happening, and they basically are saying, God's doing something in this kid's life, okay? Whereas your father was also told in 13 and following, he meets his dad, started being concerned for you, so you get the retelling of the story. Samuel in verse 17 calls the people together at Mizpah, and now they're going to kind of formally announce Saul's kingship, if you will. Okay. Verse 18, this is Samuel's speech. Read that.
But you have today rejected your God, who delivers you from all your calamities and all your distresses, yet you have said, no, but set a king over us. Now therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans.
All right, so a tough message saying you've punked God, but God is still faithful, okay? So here's what we're going to do. Now we're picking a king, okay? And Samuel knows obviously who this is. He brings the tribes near. They take Benjamin by lot. They basically whittle it down by lot all the way down to Saul's family, the son of Kish, and they pick Saul. But notice, verse 21, where is Saul? End of verse 21. Could not be found. So he's about to get anointed king and they can't find him. Where is he? Verse 22.
So they inquired again of the Lord, and there are men still to come. And the Lord said, behold, he has hid himself from the baggage.
Huh. So here you've got the big, strong, tough guy king that everybody wants, right? Head and shoulders above the rest. He's getting ready to be anointed king. He knows this, and where is he? He's hiding. He's scared to death, right? So part of that, I think, is a statement of humility on Saul's part, okay? And that's good. Part of it is, bro, you are not up for the task, okay? You are not ready to lead this nation, okay? But physically on the outside, you're exactly what everybody wants, okay? 23, keep going, and let's watch what happens.
And they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward.
Isn't it fascinating? Like, that's the description we give of Saul. It's all external, right? Gosh, he looks really impressive, okay? Keep going.
Samuel said to all the people, do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? There is none like him among all the people.
That's what you wanted, right? Is that the guy? Tall, handsome, big, strong, 22-inch biceps. Is that the guy you want? Okay, great. That's what he's saying. Keep going.
All people shouted, "Long live the king."
Yay, long live the king. That's what we wanted. We got what we wanted. Oh, wait, that's not what we wanted. 25, keep going. All right, so they have a coronation. Hey, you're the guy, okay? Saul went on his way to Gibeah, so he goes back to his home. And valiant men whose hearts God had touched had been with him, okay? 27, there's a group of people that aren't real excited about this. Read that.
But some worthless fellows said, "How can this man save us?"
So he's like at his coronation, and there's people out there punking him, right? How can this, right? And they're, unfortunately, these guys are right, but I want you to notice Saul's response. What does he do to these guys that are punking him? Okay, what does that mean? He kept silent is what my translation says. What does that tell you about Saul? What positive quality do you see in him? Yeah, he's got self-control. So there's people out there punking him. Now, he's in front of everybody. Everyone knows he's about to be king. He probably had the right or the ability to win that battle. Okay, so I like that about Saul. He keeps his peace. Okay, he kept silent, doesn't respond. Okay, so here we go. We're in a new season in Israel. The period of the judges is over. We've got the king that Israel has finally wanted, and now we're going to see how all that works out. Is this guy really what they wanted? Okay, chapter 11, we will pick up on tomorrow, and we will watch the first actions of Saul as king. And again, they're quite positive. He does a great job out of the gates, okay? But after that, he kind of loses steam. So we'll pick up on that in the mañana. All right, you guys have a fabulous day.